You know what really makes us mad? It's wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Talk about punk!
What's up, posers? Welcome to Punk's Blotto Pod. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley.
I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And this is the show where we assign a year and choose one punk, hardcore, emo, or punk-adjacent album from that year to discuss. I'm trying to think of how we do this without just diving right into what we're talking about. No guest today, obviously. But this one's in timing with your birthday.
Yeah, I didn't want to record on my birthday. That's why we didn't book a guest.
And I don't like booking on Fridays, so there we go. Yeah, you know, having some... What'd you do for your birthday?
Went on a little walk. We went out to eat. Went bowling. Yeah, it was fun.
I'm mailing you something, and hopefully you don't have it. It's been a week here. I talked about it on the Patreon. A lot of kittens in our house. Anybody want some? I'll bring them to you. I don't care where you live. I'll bring you these kittens. Gotta find them a home. Yeah, you know, just a little bit of the summer. 90 plus degree weather here in Hickory, North Carolina. But hot here. So, if you head on over to our Patreon, you get access to all of our weekly bonus audio. This week, we did a starting five on the year 1978, where we each picked five albums from that year to discuss. So, it's for $1, you get access to all of that. This maybe one of the last weeks to do this too. If you join at the $1 tier, you are automatically entered into a drawing to get the $10 tier for free, which that means you get to choose what album we talk about on the show. So if you already are a patron, you will be already entered in this. And anyone who signs up, if you sign up and unsubscribe, you're automatically entered too. I don't care. You're in there. So... looking forward to seeing who wins that and seeing what record they choose for us to talk about. And we have all the social medias, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at PunkLottoPod, email address PunkLottoPod@gmail.com, voicemail line 202-688-PUNK, and a Substack, PunkLottoPod.substack.com. Before we get into the main part of the show, I actually had something I wanted to talk about here on the top. So... friend of the show, Joel from the band Ancient Shores, sent me over a little bit of an idea that he had. So he was in a band. He was in a band before Ancient Shores, and they recorded songs like 15 years ago. They never did anything with them. They toured a lot of the Mid-Atlantic. He said they played every living room in West Virginia. They recently dug these tracks up and had Scott Evans of Kowloon Walled City mix them for them, and then Carl Saff mastered the songs. They put it up on Bandcamp. It's got a pretty cool like package to it. They're using this money to donate to the Shriners in honor of the drummer of that band who passed away. He was born with a disability, so that's why I think they went with the Shriners as their charity there. The name of the project is A Lesson Learned, and that is alessonlearned.bandcamp.com. I'll include that in the show notes. It is a 6-track little release here. They were an instrumental band who they started with vocalists, but then over time they just like wound up being just like let's just do instrumental stuff because it's fun and we like this. And I'm trying to think of the style of music it is. We've definitely played with bands like this like kind of, it's like post-hardcore, but like the songs are written kind of proggy in a way that they don't have like a standard. It's funny how much post-hardcore during that time period was the not following any sort of like standard like verse chorus format, very kind of proggy, little metalcore in there, really impressive playing on here. The drum work is fantastic, and Joel said that's one of the main reasons why they wanted to put this out is because, you know, he just wanted to hear the drumming. You know, he wanted everybody to hear Joey is his name. He's the drummer. He wanted everyone to hear this. So. It's pay what you want. Every download comes with a digital album booklet and some introspective words from the Joel and Jason from this band. And yeah, it's a cool, there's like a 10-minute commentary on the album that BJ from Ancient Shores put together for them. But yeah, check it out. It is a lessonlearned.bandcamp.com. This episode, we are talking about the year 1978. I gave you this year because what did I do? Oh yeah, I went through and I was checking all the years that we'd done, and I looked for ones that like we haven't done in the longest time, and I gave you like two, and you were like, those are my years for your calendar.
Yeah. I didn't want to cut into Patreon content because I'm going to be talking about stuff from it. Those, I think you gave me like 83 and 94. I was like, I'm doing both of those.
05. It was
05. Yeah, that's right. Like, I'm doing both of those already.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, what about 78? I think that was
one
like
year off from 77, which is also one of the years that I'm doing.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where we can talk about what you selected later. But, so yeah, 78, we've covered it in the past before. I meant to actually pull up and see which ones we had done.
Looking at the list, we definitely did Parallel Lines by Blondie.
Yeah, we did that with Groupie.
We did Give Them Enough Rope by The Clash.
Yeah. We did The Saints, Eternally Yours, way back in episode 24.
Yeah.
We also did Germ-Free Adolescence by The X-Ray Specs with good friend Corey. Corey also did the Give Him Enough Rope one, too. We gave him 78 twice.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, so those are the big ones we covered. We did also, on that Saints episode, talk about Joy Division's An Ideal for Living EP along with it in that classic format. But
yeah, we haven't touched on any other records from this year, though. So, well, I mean, other than we did definitely talk about Susie and the Banshees record, The Scream, on the Best Worst Over Under.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't go too deep on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, so the 78 records, you know, Devo, Are We Not Men? We Are Devo.
Yeah, produced by Brian Eno, who also produced the record that we're talking about today. Early Devo, very chaotic and much more guitar-driven, not the synthy poppy stuff that you're familiar with if you're really only familiar with Whip It. A great record, one that I could have chosen for sure, but definitely not my go-to with Devo. I do like this record a lot. Like, I mean, Uncontrollable Urge, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, Too Much Paranoias, a lot of incredible songs and just absolutely wild guitar sounds on that record, but not what I go for when I go for Devo. But what I do go for when I go for post-punk from this time period, so that's kind of where they line up for me, I think, on this record.
This is the year of Chairs Missing by Wire.
Better than Pink Flag.
I don't agree.
Controversial opinion.
Yes, I don't agree. I've listened to both not too long ago, and I was like, nah. I mean, Chairs Missing is good, but it's no Pink Flag for me. There are two Peer Ubu records. The Modern Dance is the first one, and it's the one that I've actually listened to and like. I wish a lot of that early Peer Ubu stuff was on Spotify, but it is not. It's,
yeah, I think Modern Dance and that's it.
I don't know that Modern Dance is even on there.
It might not be anymore. I think it was at one point.
Yeah, because a lot of the early stuff is like the most critically acclaimed stuff, and Modern Dance is on there now, and Dub Housing. I don't think it used to be. I think a lot of stuff was gone for a long time, and so... Huh, interesting. They're back now, so maybe I can listen to Modern Dance. I do like Modern Dance. I've heard other Peer Ubu, and I don't really care for them, but I like Modern Dance.
78 is, it's the Punk Gets Weird year. Magazine put out Real Life. Public Image Limited put out their first record, Public Image. I mean, even that Susie record is weird.
Yeah. There's another Blondie record this year, too. Plastic Letters.
Yeah, Plastic Letters is the one that came out with four Parallel Lines.
Right.
And it's really good. I really enjoy that record. I think it really is the place to start. Their first record is very hit or miss.
Yeah. Buzzcocks released another Music in a Different Kitchen, very different sounding band on this record. I don't ever come to this one. Also, Love Bites. A lot of double records this year. Love Bites by the Buzzcocks. I do like Love Bites. That one's really good. There's two XTC records. White Music and Go To. A second Saints album, Prehistoric Sounds. I think it's like the third record.
That's the third one, yeah.
Mm. There's a Dead Boys record I've never listened to. We Have Come For Your Children. So 78 is like still very early in punk. There's only like four pages of albums that fall under punk. And like when you get to the second page, you're like, all right, we're already on the Sham 69 and 999 records, huh?
Yeah. We get a Midnight Oil record.
We get the first Squeeze record.
Yeah. Those are definitely ones to talk about. The Kids. I mean, that's definitely an interesting record.
With the second Boys album, Alternative Chartbusters.
A Runaways record.
Mm-hmm.
Which is their third? No. Where is that in their discography? Fourth.
Hmm. Yeah, it's just like... As far as... It's interesting. What is... So 77 has that cachet. They're just being like, wow, this is the year that punk blew up. What is 78's kind of like reputation? Because it's not even like Pink Flag came out in 77. Isn't there like a Public Image record too in 77? Like the metal one? I could be wrong on that, though.
Yeah, I think that one's later. I always thought Public Image was the first one. Because Nevermind the Bollocks came out at the end of 77.
Metal Box came out in 79. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's definitely a lot of the weird stuff, and then just more records, like, you know, the next record they released, you know, like the Buzzcocks, the Ramones, you know, the stuff that we've mentioned, the Saints, you know, it's just kind of like the follow-up records that are like, maybe some of them are maybe better, some of them are maybe not, you know, it's not a year that is really dense. I think just the most really the biggest concentration of one unified punk sound in 78 is the stuff that ties into the record that we're talking about, the new wave and post-punk stuff. So your Blondie, your Devo, your Wire, your Periubu.
Yeah. It to me, it just feels like, we're over it, is kind of the sentiment that I get.
And that was definitely the UK sentiment, for sure. Like, they were done with it. Punk's dead. The Sex Pistols broke up.
What's the point anymore? We're over it. I was going to pull up EPs to see who else was doing some stuff, too, just a curiosity. Okay, we're getting little trickles over here on the States side, though. So the Misfits released the Bullet EP. The Middle Class released Out of Vogue, which is, like, one of the arguable, like, first hardcore records. Wow, Undertones released Teenage Kicks in 70. I forgot that their first record comes out, like, 79. Yeah, there's, like, a DOA 7-inch called Disco Sucks. The Flesh Eaters have an EP. Yeah, even EP-wise, it's, like, not quite there yet. I mean, Misfits doing that Bullet that early is actually kind of surprising.
The Fall put out Bingo Master's Breakout, which was their first release. I think it's their first release. Because their first single isn't until 79. No, they had a single in 78 as well. But, like, yeah, their first album isn't till 79.
The Germs did release the Lexicon Devil 7-inch, too. That's worth mentioning. Actually, a lot of singles. So, like, if you look up the singles that came out that year, Buzzcocks' Ever Fallen in Love, B-52's Rock Lobster, Gang of Four, Damaged Goods, The Cure, Killing an Arab. Said that like a fucking hillbilly. Hanging on a Telephone. I wish that was the single from the record. Hong Kong Garden by Susie and the Banshees. What Do I Get? Alternative Ulster by Stiff Little Fingers. Like, because the single was a pretty big deal still.
Yeah, Alternative Ulster would have preceded Inflammable Material, because that wasn't until 79.
Yeah.
Yeah, Suspect Device as well.
Oh, Adult Books by X came out that year, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the U.S. stuff is just really getting started. That's not the New York scene or Devo. But, yeah, so what record did you actually select?
Well, I picked it as if I were the guest. I picked the record that I felt like I could talk about the most. It's definitely one of my favorites of the year. It is definitely one of my... it is easily my favorite record by this band. It is Talking Heads and their second record, More Songs About Buildings and Food. Is a record that I love, but I often have to look up the title of.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah,
because I'm always like, it's more songs about food and cars. What is it?
Yeah, it doesn't help that End of a Year had a 7-inch too that was like more songs about like interstates and something.
Yeah,
Yeah, got some stats. Talking Heads formed in New York City in 1975. This was released July 14th, 1978. So we're coming up on the anniversary, actually, on Sire Records. This is the band's second full-length album. The personnel on this album is David Byrne on vocals, guitar, synthesized percussion, Chris France on drums and percussion, Jerry Harrison on piano, organ, keys, guitar, and vocals, and Tina Weymouth on bass. She just had one job. And the record was produced by Brian Eno, and he would add synths, piano, guitar, percussion, and vocals to the record. So this is the first of three albums that Brian Eno would produce for Talking Heads. He would also produce Fear of Music and Remain in Light.
He would also collaborate with David Byrne on other stuff, solo records and records that they did together, ambient records and things like that.
Yeah. Here's my hot take. I don't know. Is this a hot take? I think it's the best of the three records that he did with them.
Oh, yeah. And it's in order. They're in order. It's this
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
Fear of Music, Remain in Light. Remain in Light is not their best record.
Remain in Light is hard to listen to.
I like it.
It's tough.
But it's not. It just really lacks what I go to for the Talking Heads, I guess.
Yeah.
I have to treat it more like it's a Brian Eno record.
Yeah. It's too kind of just like, it's too percussive. It's too just like, look at all this weird stuff we're doing. Versus being like, where's the songs at? I mean, they do put they're one of their biggest singles ever on it, but
it's so out of place.
It doesn't fit. I bet the label made them do it.
I think so.
I never looked into it, but I bet the label's like, give us something to Rossell. iZimbra's not selling. Well, that's the Fear of Music.
That's Fear of Music.
And this is my extra hot take. I know this one's spicy. Music critics love Fear of Music. A lot of them say it's the best Talking Heads record. I disagree completely. And Fear of Music isn't even in my top five Talking Heads records.
Yeah, it might make my top five, but it's definitely not up there.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about Remain in Light. We're talking about more songs.
Yeah. So, well, obvious first question I usually ask, what made you choose this album for us to talk about?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's my favorite Talking Heads record. It's easily one of the best records from 78. A record that I would, if you were to ask me to do one of those, comprehensive lists of records, this would be on it. If you were to say like 100 greatest records of all time or something like that as the prompt, easily this was going to be on it. This is like going to be in the top 50 probably. Could very easily be much higher. I think it's just a killer record. I think it's a really interesting record. I think it's weird but fun.
Yeah, re-listening to it, I was like, this record is a little weird. Like, it's especially following up 77, it's just like a strange record that works really well. Like, this is my favorite Talking Heads record. Easy my favorite album by them. Like, no question. But whenever you take the tracks out individually, I actually sometimes question that. I'm like, is this my favorite record when I listen to just one song? But it's like all together, I think, is what makes it my favorite. Because there are singles I like more from other records, but the rest of the album built around them I don't like as much as this one.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Singles from this record, Take Me to the River is the single.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why. It's the song that people would recognize as being an Al Green song. They do put a very unique spin on it that does hint towards the kinds of some of the singles that they would do later. I think it has a similar tone and feeling to it that Once in a Lifetime does. If you're gonna pick something from this record that you're gonna push to radio, that's the one. As far as like songs that stand out to me on their own from this record, Artists Only is probably the one, and The Big Country, but that's such a different song too. Again, not really a single song. It's interesting how the songs themselves don't really stand out super well on this record, but I still love this record overall. And I think it has a lot to do with the way that they're sequenced. in the production, and little things about each song, because every song kind of has its one little thing, whether it's like Tina's bass part or the whatever melody that David Byrne is singing, or like whatever effect is being used really prominently. There's something specific and special about each song. And it, on the sequencing thing, I think I've mentioned this before. Maybe we've talked about this record in passing before, but it's a fun record to listen to in the way that it builds up and then breaks. Because songs like Thank You for Sending Me an Angel, like, it's kind of just this little vamping little riff.
A little gallopy sort of thing.
And that's kind of all the song is. And like the songs kind of gain tempo or gain energy, like, and then you get The Girls Want to Be with the Girls, which is just like slamming keyboards and girls want to be with the girls. Like, and then when, you know, and it builds up more energy into Found a Job, which is a really great song that I think that stands out on its own. And then you flip the record over and Artists Only just kicks off so hard. And you're like, whoa, you would think that you would want that punch of like really danceable in your face energy on the front side. And then it slows down on, you know, the last two tracks. So it kind of just has this cool off at the end. It's a really well sequenced record. I think that's one of the most important parts of it. And it hits me every time I listen to it.
Yeah. It's definitely like a building, to a peak and then like coming down. But even then, like, the final two tracks are just so big, so good. Like, their version of Take Me to the River is incredible. Like, it just has this huge drum sound to it, fun bass work. Like, the bass is kind of like the controller of this song. The organs on here, that, like, what do you call that? It's like this weird, when he's playing the organ, he does this thing where he like hits like a high extra key that just like brick at the end of like the line, you know what I mean? You know that part? It has this huge crescendo.
Yeah, the little quirks and, yeah. I mean, there's just something about the way that a Hammond organ works that I don't understand, but.
This organ, there's another song that I think of, too, that has a similar sounding organ. Is it a Don Henley song? Kicking When They're Up, Kicking When They're Down. I think that same organ's in that song. Is that Don Henley? It's funny that, like, that was the single, though. It's just, like, it was their first top 30 hit, which is funny because it's, like, oh, it's a cover and it's very different from the original. But I also don't know what else I would have picked off this record to make a single either. Warning Sign? Is Warning Sign the one that, like, feels like it could stand on its own the best? But even then,
it's so weird.
He's got the robot voice and, like, his hands cupped around his mouth. Yeah. I move around like that.
Look at my hair. Moves back and forth. It's so weird. It's too weird. Everything else is on here is just too weird to be a single for a new band, which, you know, they're a band that would become known as a weird band anyway. So,
yeah. I mean, Big Country, you can't take it out of the context of the album. It also feels very different from the rest of the record, too. Which Tina Weymouth didn't like it. She also thought the song was mean-spirited.
It's an interesting song.
It's my favorite song on the album.
I know what she means by it being mean-spirited. I mean, it's an interesting song in their discography. I think it's an interesting song when you can compare it to songs that they would do later in their career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's an interesting song to listen to as a young person and then listen to it as an older person. Because, I mean, I've been listening to this record for... I was trying to think of when I got this. You gave it to me for Christmas, like, probably 10 years ago.
Is it that far back?
Yeah. Because, like, I definitely remember listening to this record in, you know, the first apartment we lived in after I got married. So, like, feels like a very, very long time ago.
see the shoreline. I see the white caps, a baseball diamond. Nice weather down there. I see the school and the houses where the kids are. Places to park by the factories and buildings, restaurants and bars for later in the evening. When we come to the farmlands and the undeveloped areas, and I have learned how these things work together.
I was trying to think. So I was thinking about, like, that talk, like, my, when did, how did I become a Talking Heads fan? So, like, yeah, everybody knows the singles, like, Burning Down the House, Same as It Ever Was, you know, the big ones. And so, like, I knew the singles. I'm trying to remember, like, what motivated me to, like, actually listen to them. I did start with the greatest hits, though. I was like, I like the singles. Let me listen to them all back to back. And I listened to all the singles. Some Greatest Hits album, like the one with like pictures of heads just floating. I forget the name of that one, but I was like, okay, I like all these singles. I don't think I knew Take Me to the River. So when I heard it, I was like, oh, this is different. I must have started with this album. I feel like this is the one I started with, but I also don't know for a fact. I would have had to have downloaded it and like burned it to a CD. This may have been the first one I did. Honestly, it might be because of End of a Year. So End of a Year did that 7-inch that was called More Songs About Transportation and Intercourse. And they do a rip of this album cover on the 7-inch. But the 7-inch does a... It's funny. They do a version of Wild Wild Life, which is not off this record. And they forgot a verse. And it ends with a really funny thing of like Pat yelling. He's like, what? There's like a whole other verse here. What? Why? We didn't record the whole thing, and like the band just forgot to record the third verse or something. And so he realized that in the recording of his vocals that they didn't finish the song. So that might have been the thing that was just like, because I was listening to everything they put out at the time, and that probably would have been the thing to be like, maybe I'll check that one out that has like the red bricks on it. It's like, it's a photo collage of the band. So I don't know, maybe because it's the first one I ever listened to, then that's why it like hit me just right. I don't know. Do you remember the first one you heard?
I don't. I don't remember specifically which record I listened to first. This one would have been early on, though. I wouldn't be surprised if it was 77.
Yeah.
Just because that's like the punk cred one, you know. And it's the first one. And it has Psycho Killer.
Yeah. There's a chance I listened to Speaking in Tongues just because it had Burning Down the House and I maybe would have tried it, but it didn't stick the way this one did, which I do love Speaking in Tongues. I think it's a great record. My favorite Talking Heads records are the more pop ones, which this one is a little bit of both, I guess. Maybe that's what I like the most about it. It does feel a little bit like it should be one of their pop records, but it's not.
Yeah, this record is the beginning of their dabbling in like that heavily world music influenced sound and all of the like really rhythmically focused aspects of the band. They chose to work with Brian Eno because he approached them after seeing them open for the Ramones on tour in the UK. I think it was in the UK. And so he was like, hey, let's get together and let's talk. So he played for them a Fela Kuti record, Aphrodisiac maybe. So that was like a new thing for them. They're like, oh, whoa, what is this music?
They were also really getting into Parliament, mm-hmm. Funkadelic too, and George Clinton stuff, which I'm like, what? What was Parliament and Funkadelic doing? And there is a Funkadelic record, or is a Parliament record in 78, or is it both? Let's see. Parliament.
I could have been listening to any old Parliament put out
Motor Booty Affair.
Motor Booty Affair. I was going to say, I know that record. I have that record. That's a good one.
And there's a Bootsy record, Bootsy Collins record. Yeah, but I guess they could have just been listening to any older Parliament record. But it's just like, I don't know. Parliament and Funkadelic are even, they're even weirder than the Talking Heads get.
Yeah, they're condensed. I mean, they kind of condense funk into something else.
For white people.
I mean, you know, there's definitely that accusation that they made funk for white people. And like, they definitely were so heavily influenced by funk. But it's not a new thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and the band made funk for white people, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a thing. I mean, play the funky music, white boy. White guy singing that one.
Average white band.
And it doesn't really sound like, it doesn't sound like Earth, Wind, and Fire. Even though they did say they were listening to a lot of Earth, Wind, and Fire, too. But I don't hear that, really, on this record. Other than maybe the bass work or some guitar riffs. I don't know. They don't... You listen to this record, and it doesn't feel like a funk record. So
it's funky.
Yeah, but not a funk album.
No.
Yeah, I was reading... Eno, he had already left Roxy Music by this point. He'd already done a couple solo albums. He had just finished up David Bowie's Low before doing this one. Like, it either that one, and then came to this one. Which the label was like, I don't know about this Eno guy. Like... They weren't even sure about Low yet because it was so different.
Yeah, I mean, all of the Bowie Eno stuff from this time period was Bowie's label was unsure of.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then what else had Eno had done the Devo record and that's it. Yeah, his own weird records.
Yeah, I actually read this too. Right before this album, they went to record this album. They were touring Europe with XTC and Dire Straits, and like Dire Straits hadn't even had a hit yet, like it was that early. But they were also touring Europe in the winter, and they were like this is miserable, we hate this so much, it sucks so bad, this these crowds suck. And then they were offered a tour of the US with Elvis Costello, and so they canceled their rest of their European tour and went to America and toured with Costello because they were so happy to like be done. Which apparently, like, pissed a lot of people off in, like, the UK for a couple years. So the UK was resistant to them because they abandoned us or whatever. So, yeah. They did supporting act of Elvis Costello in the US instead. So with that being said, after 77 came out, they basically, like, toured. Just, like, nonstop. It was just a touring thing. They just, you know, were playing everywhere. And they was like, all right, time to make the new record. And they're like, haven't written anything yet. And
well, they had a bunch of these songs. They've toured on a lot of these songs.
So these were all songs that they had for Talking Heads 77 that they were like, these aren't good enough to record.
Yeah.
So it's that, we have these leftovers, and apparently David's a really slow writer, so it was just like, we got to record something. Here's these leftovers, and... It might explain why they don't stand out as, like, individual tracks as much. And I bet without Eno's production on this thing, it probably wouldn't have been as good. Or it just would have been like, it's the sophomore slump for you.
I don't know. It's hard to say. Because Eno's production on this, compared to what his production is like on a lot of other people's records... And even on the later Talking Heads records that he did with them, it's very minimal. It's much less intrusive than he typically is. There are definitely like, you know, reverb and EQ and like other effects decisions that were probably his to make that he really imparted on the songs. But the songs themselves, like those great bass lines that's pure Tina. I mean...
Well, one of the things that they always say about him is that he pushed them to put the bass and rhythm in the forefront of the album. So, like, that was not the original arrangement, I guess. And so, like, he was just like, no, make these dancey. Like, push the bass to the front. Like, let this shine. So I think when you do listen to this compared to 77, it's like, yeah, it's the same band, but they feel very different to me. Like a different, they were writing a different kind of record than 77.
I think they're a, and this is something that they've said, I think that they were a more polished band. They were a tighter band, just from having played so much.
Yeah.
In between making the first record and making this one, that they just kind of rolled into the studio, which they recorded this in the Bahamas.
Yeah. Nassau. Yeah.
It was something like that. And they were just like, so there was, it was just this really easy production. It was like a really nice place to record. And then Eno was like really easy to work with. And I think that they just turned in good songs. They did, I think they said they did like, they did tons of takes on everything, but they ended up with like the third or fourth, almost always picking like the third or fourth take.
Yeah.
For everything.
He like had them just like play the whole songs too. I guess it was during the tracking phase, like the, or the demo phase where they were like recording what the song was going to be and just like let them just like, nah, let's just do it live in studio. Let's just record it all at one go instead of breaking them down. Apparently like they were saying that like, oh yeah, production back then, like the band wasn't allowed really in the studio side. Like they were like, you know, in the control room. It was like, he said it was like, it's like they were wearing lab coats and they were scientists experimenting on the band, and you basically weren't allowed to go in there and help out. And then the Eno like was the first to really bring them in and let them like in the control room and like sit in, and probably more what it's like now.
Yeah.
The album did well. It reached number 29 on the Billboard Pop Album chart. It's pretty good. Like I said, Take Me to the River was their first top 30 single. I was looking at, I was like, Tina Weymouth says the album is named basically after just like, what are we going to do? Just write a record about more songs and food, or more, more buildings and food. And they're like, yeah, that's it. That's what we're going to call it. And then also, Andy Partridge says of XTC says he gave it to David Byrne. He gave that line to David Byrne. So there's a little bit of debate on like who came up with that.
Yeah, I think the first one's more plausible.
Yeah, yeah, I said that. It's just really funny.
Yeah,
yeah, I gave it to him. They were touring with us. I gave it to him.
Oh yeah, yeah, I gave him that. Yeah, I don't know. that sounds suspicious. It makes more sense to me that the album was album title was a self-effacing joke, because they were just like, hey, these songs are boring. Like these songs are about boring things.
Yeah. I read the lyrics and I'm like, what are these? What? This is nonsense to me. Like they don't really, there's only a couple songs where I was like, oh, there's an actual like narrative kind of here. Otherwise it's just like, I do things this way. I do things that way. It's just like, what do you, what? Big Country actually has a little bit of a structure, and there's one song, what's the other one that's like found a job. Like, that one's got a little story to it, too. But everything else is just, like, I don't know. It's gibberish. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, artists only... I'm painting again. I'm cleaning again. I'm cleaning my brain. I mean, you know, a song that's kind of about, like, creative process. David Byrne is interesting, frustrating, thought-provoking. I think he can be really meaningful and really obtuse in the same song, which I think is, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, that's kind of a lyric writing approach to just, like, write something that rhymes or just write something that sounds interesting without trying to guide it towards any specific meaning. I think it can be a contrast to the things that you're saying that really mean something compared to something that is just like word association. I don't know. I think that can be interesting. And I think he does it well. I think the lyrics on this record are interesting, even if they are like, he's literally saying goo goo gaga.
Goo.
You know?
Gaga gaga. Yeah, that's in Big Country about I wouldn't want to live there, you know.
Which, and the structure of that song, going back, I was kind of talking about this like earlier, is like he's just describing things, and he's kind of just describing America, really from the perspective of someone who's just passing through it.
He's flying over. He said he got the idea from looking out a window in airplane. And he's just like, oh, look at that town down there with their nice little cafeterias. Their lunch is one of the things he mentions. And I bet they got real good food there. And just like, but then he gets to the chorus. He's like, but I wouldn't want to live there if you paid me.
Yeah.
And like, that's what Tina was like. It's a mean-spirited song. And also, she thought the song was just tacked on to the end of the record, too. She's like, it doesn't fit with the rest of the album, which I agree it doesn't, but fits their sound. And he has since said, like, no, I actually really respect... This is like in a 2015 interview. He's like, I really respect middle America. It's like, man, you're a city guy. That's what you are. I mean...
Well, it's... Yeah, I mean, it's a liberal elite artist.
Flyover...
City guy flying over America and being like,
ooh, I wouldn't want to live there.
Well, it's interesting because he's like, in the song, he's saying like, I get it. Like, you know, I guess it's healthy and like they have their little towns and their communities and they're happy. And but no, I don't want that. Ew. And but it's honestly, it's funny to like to grow up in a kind of like rural place and then, you know, moving to major cities for me and like driving across the country and seeing like middle America specifically and being like, yeah, I don't want to live here.
Yeah,
but then also like I can count on my hands, well, I can, most of the times that I have listened to this record have been listening to the LP in my home doing very domestic things, just doing the dishes, cleaning the house, being at home. So it's funny to have that juxtaposition in the song, in my own personal listening to the song, in their catalog too, when you consider like a song like Nothing But Flowers, where he's like kind of again grappling with the idea of like idyllic natural world versus commercialization.
And as someone who lives in the part of the country that he was singing about, I get it. Like, I get it. I don't want to live here.
And I have conversations with people here in LA that are like, oh, I want to get out of LA. Oh, I want to move to the Pacific Northwest. I'm like, have you ever... Oh, you've never lived there. You don't know. You don't know what it's like to live in a forest where it rains all the time. You don't know what it's like to have 5 restaurants that you go to.
Well, and if you're a vegetarian, 2.
2, yeah. Yeah, right. If you have any kind of dietary restrictions.
Well, I don't want to go to the hamburger restaurant or the hamburger restaurant or the hamburger restaurant. I guess I go to the pizza place or the Mexican place or the Asian place. Because those places I can at least be like, No meat, please. Fried chicken place, I don't know what you're going to get. You can have the wedges. Yeah. Yeah, it is funny when people who are like from cities like, I just want to get away. And then it turns into a culture shock. They're just like, oh, it's awful here. People are so awful. Oh, their beliefs. Oh. It's like, yeah, you just were ignoring that, you know, people have those beliefs that you don't agree with. They're everywhere. But yeah. It is my favorite Talking Heads record. Looking at the rest of the discography, it's funny. God, people really love Remain in Light. God, why is the score so high on that record? Jeez. It's the highest rated score on Rate Your Music. And I think it's like the second worst album they put out.
What's below it? Naked?
Yeah, Naked's just not very good.
It's just a weird day.
It's got one really good song. Yeah, like, so, yeah, it's my favorite. And then I probably put, like, Little Creatures right behind. I love Little Creatures. And then maybe Speaking in Tongues. But yeah, Little Creatures. Little Creatures, though, it was their best-selling album. I was surprised to hear that. Huh, maybe that's the why you find that one in every used record store the most. So we'll never have a Talking Heads reunion, right? Like, ever.
I don't know. I don't know if it's even... I don't even know if they hate each other enough to say never.
But they don't like each other enough.
That it's highly unlikely. And I think that none of them need it.
Right. I mean...
Neither, like... And I mean, you know, say what you will about David Byrne being, like, I don't know, like, hard to work with. And I don't think that he would... And I mean, he does play the old Talking Heads songs himself.
Yeah. Well, to me, that is, I don't need them to do this.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, probably. He gets the same reaction, I think. I don't know.
I think he gets what he needs out of that by doing that. I think he gets the audience satisfaction that he's playing the old stuff. I think that he gets to play those songs and enjoy them as much as he wants to. And he doesn't have to work with anyone else.
He does.
The people that play the songs with him now are just doing a job.
Yeah. They don't have opinions and will argue with me. Which is like, well, I feel like these records are as good as they are because it was a collaborative thing. Because really, do you care about any David Byrne solo records?
No.
Like, I mean, it doesn't. Doesn't help he doesn't try and do anything even close to Talking Heads like style. But even when he did, though, right, there's like one or two records, and like, let's see, not the Eno stuff, because that's just them being Eno. He has like an album in like 89, yeah, like Uh-Oh, or 94's David Byrne. I don't know, I've never listened to those records to know. And it's just like, I don't know anybody who cares about those records. Like, who cares about solo David Byrne that's not an Eno collaborative album?
Well, yeah, I guess he's done other collaborations that people
Fatboy are Slim, interested St. in. Vincent.
But yeah, probably mostly because of who he's collaborating with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't think any of them... Yeah. I don't think any of them... would find it rewarding to play the old songs. I mean, like I said, I don't think they need it. I don't think that they enjoyed doing it when they were doing it enough to want to revisit it. Like, I don't think that any of them have like nostalgia for it. So it's not going to be like, oh, we're going to relive our glory days.
Yeah. Which it's funny, because it's like Chris and Tina are still married. So it's like you just get them on board and you can do it. Apparently, right before recording, Jerry moved in with David. Like, Jerry and his partner, and David and his girlfriend at the time. So it became these two units against, like, kind of on opposite ends. So it was like David and Jerry, and then Chris and Tina were like the two opposite sides, the two little camps of the band, which I'm sure didn't help the dynamics in the future. We know where they became a little rough being in the band with each other. But yeah, I wonder if Jerry wound up staying. Well, Jerry wound up doing that record with Chris and Tina, though, the Heads record with all those guest vocalists. No Talking, just Head. I think they got sued too to stop using that name or something like that. But yeah, I don't know. I think I've run out of all my thoughts on this record. Any closing thoughts?
No, I think that's good. I think we hit all of the major points on this one. I don't think we need to belabor any points.
Yeah, I think that will do it for us today then. So thank you everyone for listening to the show, and I hope you enjoyed it. And we will see you next week.